welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we open with Robert Glasper's Butterfly from Double Booked. And I thought it would be a great sort of theme for this conversation that we're going to be having with Jackie Jones, who is the director and producer of a new film about the crisis in American schools called 180 Days, A Year Inside an American High School, which is airing on Monday and Tuesday, March 25th and 26th, just next week, at 9 o'clock on public broadcasting stations. Welcome to the show, Jackie. Good morning.
Good morning, Wanda.
Great to have you with us. And this film is this insider look is just, wow, people are going to just be really appalled and shocked to see what our tax dollars are not doing, how they're not, you know, being used successfully, to reach a lot of poor students and, you know, students that represent the norm throughout our country. But these particular students are a part of Washington Metropolitan High School, or D.C. Met, and we were talking before we went on the air how this particular school is within a stone's throw, literally, of the Capitol.
Indeed it is. It's you can see right down North Capitol to the actual Capitol. So it is kind of shocking that a school so close is so under-resourced. But I have to say that there are a lot of challenges that the school has, and the kids especially have. But I think the other thing about the film that's important to note is that it also shows how really heroic so many of the teachers are. I think we've heard so much lately about bad teachers and how teaching is really the problem in our schools. And I think what we found, like, you know, living and breathing the story for a year, is that the teachers do, above and beyond the call of duty. The issue really is about how resources are allocated and how we as a society also allow the schools to bear the brunt of so many things that are wrong in our society. I mean, kids can look around and see what's really valued in our society today, and it's not education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading some of the program notes. It says Washington, D.C. became the school reform movement's ground zero in 2007 when Michelle Rhee, is it Rhee or Ray?
Rhee.
Rhee became school's chancellor. Test scores rose and fell, and now the nation's capital tops the list of major U.S. cities for its glaring achievement gap. White students best black students by a margin of as much as 4-1. The United States ranks near the bottom of all indexes for education among industrialized nations, and most African-American children now attend schools in which graduation is not the norm. School reform has brought numerous changes and has emphasized standardized testing, partially promoted by the Obama administration's Race to the Top initiative, in which school funding and personnel decisions are based largely on the results of high-stakes standardized tests. Tests, however, don't take into account the troubled population of the school at the center of the documentary, Washington Metropolitan High School, a school for children at risk of dropping out. It doesn't measure the effect that a parent is dying or a baby coming or a displacement by Hurricane Katrina or drug-addicted parents or the foster care system have on a student's ability to succeed or even show up for school. And it doesn't measure the desperate efforts of a school faculty working to reach these children. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the film, and then I'll introduce you properly by reading your bio. But maybe you could tell us about the five children that you follow, and these great teachers led by a wonderful principal.
Well, the kids, I mean, you know, people have asked us a lot, how do we choose these kids and why these five kids? And the truth is we started out with more than five kids. Mm. And we were really looking for kids who kind of volunteered. I mean, several kids really wanted to be in the film. And as we went through the year, other characters emerged just based on what was happening in their lives. And so we ended up with the 5 really amazing kids. And the reason that I say they're amazing is not because they're going through a lot, but because they were incredibly eloquent about their own experiences. I think particularly like with the teen mom that we focus on, who was displaced by Hurricane Katrina and, you know, spent her early teen years just moving from place to place as her mother was sort of trying to recover both emotionally and economically from that devastating hurricane. What you hear her saying, you know, is that she's aware that, you know, she's trying to fill this loss with something. And the thing that she really comes up with to fill it with is this baby. So it's not the kind of thing that I think people throw out there where, you know, young women are just careless about birth control or they just, you know, don't care about becoming teen mothers. It was an actual intentional choice that she made to fill a void. And I think when you hear from the kids and you really hear them talk about not the challenges from a day-to-day standpoint, but the challenges as human beings, the anger and the hurt and the insecurity and the fear that really go hand in hand with poverty that we just overlook. And I think that is the challenge of teachers and school leaders who are really trying to re-engage the kids in their learning and expose the kids to a different set of opportunities than what they're aware of.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And another what I really liked about your following Raven is, you know, her baby is just so beautiful.
Right.
She's in all these different programs to sort of help her be a better mother. And the child's father is also in her life.
Right.
And, you know, you show them, you know, at the graduation, and she's one of the only young mothers there that has the father as well.
Right.
Which is really great.
I know.
Yeah.
And it's really, I mean, when you see the two of them also trying to figure out their relationship and how do we do this. And, I mean, you know, I think it really dispels a lot of myths about teen parents. She's very committed to breaking the cycle. You know, she herself doesn't have the knowledge to do that, but she's looking for every possible person that can mentor her and help her, mm-hmm. because she knows that she's trapped in that and she's trying to work to get out. I mean, when you think about her as a 17-year-old getting up at 5:00 in the morning, getting that baby ready for daycare, then getting herself to school, and then going to a part-time job to help out not only with her expenses with the baby, but with her family's expenses. When you see all of that happening, and then you think to yourself, how am I going to be studying for my Algebra 2 test? You know, how am I going to spend the time that I need to focus on my academics? And there's nothing that one teacher can do that can turn all that around.
Right, yeah. And then when she takes the baby for her checkup and shots, she asked the doctor for a note for school. She said, "Oh, you're missing school," you know, with a surprise in her voice. And she said,
right.
Yeah, it's like, wow, yeah, I'm a teenager that's actually in high school. Yeah, I thought that was, I liked that, that particular scene. And hadn't realized that there were 2 Ravens in the other Raven story.
Right.
You know, she's a really amazing. When she talks about why she used to rob people, because she was just feeling so bad, and you know, she's in a foster care, the foster care system, and when she talks about how far she has to travel, I mean, you know, in the latest place that she's at is nowhere near the school.
Right.
And how she has to travel so far and how she decided to transform her life and stop robbing people, and just because she needed to do something with that energy because she was so upset. It's like, wow, I never, you know, sort of got on the inside of the person who was doing the criminal behavior, like what's motivating them.
Right.
It's not
right.
that I need
I mean,
the money or I need the whatever. It's like I got to do something with this this pain that I'm experiencing, so I'm going to hurt you because I'm hurting and I can't do anything about it because I'm not in control, perhaps.
And I think, you know, the scene in Raven's story that always just gets me is the scene where she's in her room and you see that whole memorial wall that she has to all of her friends that have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly that one, there's a T-shirt on the wall that has rest in peace and the names of at least 10 kids.
Right.
And those kids were all killed, probably by other kids, in 1 year. One school year at one school.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about, I mean, just the psychic pain of that and trauma,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, that has to go somewhere. And I think those are the things that we need to sort of take into account as a society. I don't think it's something that should only be placed at the foot of a school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, And the boys, you know, their stories are really something too. Particularly the child, I think it's Rufus, who whose mother dies, and I'm not quite clear if anybody's living in that house with he and his brother, or are they by themselves? Because he talks about how when his mother was dying, as I think she had cancer. You know, she encouraged them, and other people would come over the house and sort of help out. And then when she was gone, all that assistance evaporated. So I'm wondering, like, who are their support persons?
Well, that is actually Delonte. They're two boys
in the film. Oh,
that's Delonte?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're two boys in the film who lose their mothers. And actually, over the 2 years that we were basically in the school, the first year doing pre-production and doing, you know, just getting to understand the school community. Over those 2 years, at least a dozen kids lost parents. And I think that's another thing that we don't really think about when we think about poverty is that, you know, when both of them lost their mother to cancer, one to breast cancer, one to lung cancer, and just the nature of being poor and getting health care, by the time you go in for whatever it is that's bothering you, it's already at a stage 4.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are young people. Their parents are probably in their late 30s, early 40s at the most, that are dying of cancer. And in the case of Delonte, it is a house full of kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, the oldest person, the person that assumed guardianship was 21 years old. You know, and in the case of Rufus, who also lost his mother, he, you know, got their family got evicted the next day. I'm not the next day, but the following week, because I guess that had already been in process. And then his father wasn't employed and there was no way to stop it. And he ends up, you know, living with a cousin who, I don't want to give this part away, but you know what I mean? Sort of disrupts his life even more, not intentionally, but disrupts his life even more. So it's that whole, you know, like insecurity and instability that kids are living with by virtue of being born poor, frankly, you know? But I also don't, I mean, it's also not, you know, 4 hours of like sad stories about being poor.
No, it's not.
There's also a lot of really, really inspirational things that happen and really wonderful things that happen throughout the course of the year.
Yeah, and that's often the case. You know, children show up. You know, we start on the first day of school. We get the pep talk, you know, in the staff room, you know, where the principal, Tanisha Williams-Finer, is letting the faculty know about the new laws and the you know, how many students they have coming in and how many they need, how many more they need, you know, in order to get all the funding and so that they can all stay employed for that the school year. And, yeah, she's great. I love the staff sessions, particularly the one with the eggs. You know, she's, you know, demonstrating how the faculty need to support each other and help each other, help the students.
You know? I love that.
Yeah, that's a great one. Yeah, and then I love it when you know, all the hugs and shaking hands with the kids and the cheerleading moves. That's like, wow, look at the principal. Like, well, look at her. Like, wow.
And that's after a whole day of doing what she does, you know. So we don't know how she has the energy to do what she does. She's still like an Energizer bunny to this day. So we're all amazed by her. But also the fact that we were did a panel discussion in D.C. last night with some kids.
Oh.
And one of the things that the kids say, and you hear it a lot, like from kids, is that, you know, we want to be somewhere where we feel like we're loved, you know. And I think that's the thing that just radiates from Tanisha, is that she really loves those kids, you know, and she has the highest expectations of them, even when they're doing the wrong thing or making bad choices. They're kids, you know what I mean? And kids do that. They make bad choices. So you got to love them anyway. I mean, every parent knows that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You don't stop loving your kid because they do something stupid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, the school, you know, that, you know, under her leadership, you know, that's been created, DC Met, it's certainly a place where children can come and be successful, and the teachers and the support faculty and staff, because Coach talks about how, you know, everyone as a teacher, I just love, you know, his sessions with, you know, his when he talks about, you know, he's the coach, and there's only one. Is that Gary Barnes? No, that's Jonathan Smith, right?
No,
that's Gary Barnes. Gary Barnes, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Jonathan. Yeah, he's great. And then, you know, talking about his prior career as a he worked in corrections. I'm like, whoa, that's amazing. And talking about his background, and then Jonathan Smith, you know, the first year teacher, he's like 23. I'm like, he is heavy young. He is like, whoa. And then, yeah, he's like not much. I mean, there's not much time separating him from his students, because the students, you know, are older teenagers. I mean, you know, 17, 18. So
right.
He's 23. He could be their big brother.
Exactly. I know.
Yeah, it's really great. So now let me introduce you properly, and we can talk about how you all did this, because you tell me, you know, I'm not working alone. I have a team. So Jackie Jones is the executive director of the National Black Programming Consortium, NBPC, and the executive producer of DC Met. Since taking over leadership of NBPC, Jackie has established herself as a leader in the evolving next media landscape through innovative partnerships and initiatives such as the Katrina Project, the groundbreaking New Media Institute, the Public Media Corps, and blackpublicmedia.org. She was previously the executive vice president of Roja, R-O-J-A,
mm-hmm.
Productions in New York City, a producer of high-impact media for public television and museums. Jackie is also a Peabody Award-winning producer and director of documentary films. Which ones?
Africans in America was the film I won a Peabody for. It was a four-part series about slavery in America.
Mm-hmm.
Matters of Race is another film series that I've senior produced. I've also produced a couple of films for other non-PBS entities like Showtime and History Channel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that the Behind Closed Doors, Sex in the 20th Century?
That, right. That was
The World
for
Before
Showtime.
Us. Mm-hmm.
That was for, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So The World Before Us, what's that about?
That was a series of short films that were about, like, seminal moments in world history.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked at all kinds of things, from the election of Kwame Nkrumah as the first black, you know, independence president, to the libraries of Timbuktu, to Josephine Baker's intervention in World War II as a spy for the French, to the Hungarian Revolution. It was like all over the world. It was actually probably the most exciting project I did just by virtue of being able to travel to all those places, many of which I would have never gone to, mm-hmm. you know, as a tourist like Hungary.
Yeah,
so
wow.
It was cool. It was very
yeah.
cool.
So you were in Timbuktu?
I went to Timbuktu, yeah.
Nice,
yeah.
Yeah. How long ago was that?
That was about maybe a little over 10 years ago.
Okay, yeah, awesome, awesome. You probably, when you reflect on what's happening in northern Mali now.
I know, it's terrible. It's
yeah,
really sad.
Yeah. Yeah, I was.
It's really sad that those so much of those traditional structures have been lost. And I mean, it was amazing. I had never been, you know, really in a desert like that before, and to see like the Tuareg people literally come in the morning and like a long train of camels in their robes, and you know, and then leave as the sun goes down. It was pretty amazing and dramatic. And then those thousands of year old structures. I mean, it is really hot in Timbuktu. Like, you can't do anything during the middle of the day because it's like 120 degrees. But inside of those structures, it's completely cool,
mm-hmm.
naturally, because of the way that they're made by, you know, with mud and no windows. And so you go in there, and it's like it's air-conditioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and isn't it really cool the way there's rice mixed in with the mud? And so
mm-hmm.
in the old, and you know, you see the rice sort of coming out, and you see piles of rice inside
mm-hmm.
of the structures. And just, I just sort of think about Usman Sembin's films, right? And
mm-hmm.
he, you know, in some of them you see these structures that sort of remind you of the anthills.
Right.
In the architecture, and it's like, whoa.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, it was really neat. I was there for the, a music festival.
Oh, that must have been cool.
Yeah, it was neat, and you're right. It's like I don't think I could live in the desert like all the time. That's like serious. Like, how do you stay clean? How do you keep the sand out of your face and nose when you go to sleep? Like, and I actually camped out. I slept in a tent. So
wow.
Yeah, it was pretty adventurous, but it was fun. Yeah, and you have a BA in English from Howard University and an MA from Stanford University. Stanford University's documentary filmmaking program, which is renowned, and you've been a Revson Fellow at Columbia University and a scholar in residence at American University in Washington, D.C., and you currently serve as vice chair of the Integrated Media Association Board and on the Community Advisory Board of WHUT Howard University Television. And as I was looking at some of the planning clips, you all engage young people in the whole idea of this initiative, which what is it called? Is a part of the American
no, I am
Graduate.
The light. Right.
I am the light. Yeah, yeah. And so in New York, there is this school, and this young people, and what they're studying is advertising. And
mm-hmm.
that clip was really interesting, particularly the person who talked about finding them. So I wonder if you could talk about how you all pulled this wonderful series together and who your partners are in the film.
Well, we have a lot of partners in the film, starting with PBS, of course, and all of the PBS stations. We've partnered with 23, I think, stations around the country to do to take a deeper dive around the issues, particularly with young people and surfacing young people's voices as filmmakers and storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
So we launched, as part of the rollout to 180 Days, the American Graduate Student Film Festival, which is online. People
mm-hmm.
should go there and vote for their favorite film.
Okay.
And there were over, I think there were 33 films from all over the country, including Native American reservations and New Orleans, Philly, I mean, just everywhere, where people talking about really, really different issues, Mississippi
mm-hmm.
And other parts of the South. So I really encourage people to check that out. And then through the TED Talks, you know, are you familiar with TED? And TED is a an annual convening of thinkers and practitioners around sort of social justice issues, but through a really progressive lens. So, I mean, you could approach it from a micro-lending standpoint. You could address it from a content production standpoint. Just people who are thinking out the box of how do we solve some of the problems that we see around us. And then they started doing these little satellite things called TEDxs, where they get together just real innovators from communities and spend a day just throwing out ideas. So people talk for no more than 3 minutes, but they just throw out idea after idea after idea. So they did one of these in Harlem, and our office is located in Harlem. They did a TEDx at the Riverside Church. And very famous and very wonderful place. One of the talks was about this high school in Brooklyn called IAM, which is the Institute for Advanced Media Studies.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of the high school was that it's partnered with an advertising trade organization, and the advertising trade organization called the 4As gets like real advertising executives to teach and mentor the kids. So when they were doing their TEDx, they were saying that they were launching an actual advertising agency inside their school that would be totally run by students. So we thought, you know, we have to partner with these guys because we really, I mean, part of the whole idea behind the film is we've heard so much from experts and Michelle Rhee and Bill Gates and, you know, everybody else, Arne Duncan, President Obama, about what's wrong with public schools and how we're going to fix public schools, but who we haven't heard from is the kids. So we thought, like, who better to help us, you know, really amplify the voices of the kids than other kids? So we started working with them probably about 6 months ago, and they came up with a campaign called I Am the Light to have people basically upload videos saying what they think are solutions to the problems that they see. And their goal is to get 1.2 million people to log on to the campaign in any way through Twitter, Instagram, or you can actually upload a video online. And the 1.2 million figure represents the number of kids who drop out every year. And when I checked last night, they were up to 550,000. So they are almost halfway there, and I encourage your listeners to help them get there.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. That's another thing that's really great about the film is the reality checks that happen with regards to the statistics. And the principal also, like when she talks to the ninth graders, the entering ninth graders, you know, telling them that how important ninth grade is and the statistics around who graduates. Okay, she says, look to your left, look to your right, you know, insofar as, you know, how those, you know, one of them is probably not going to continue and graduate, you know, 4 years down the road. And then the excitement, you know, juxtaposing that with the excitement of their first graduating class.
Right.
Yeah, which is was in 2012.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So tell us, you know, what the principal's backstory is. How, you know, she tells us, you know, sort of how she came to the position. But it was more circuitous the way she ended up as principal of this you know, wonderful and sort of innovative high school.
Well, we met her when she was a principal of another high school called Spingarn. And she was really focused on a program that was for adult learners, like older teenagers and young adults that had been disengaged from school for one reason or another. And I think I can't really speak for her, but I've spent a lot of time around her, so I will speak for her anyway. I think that, you know, her real passion is re-engaging learners who have become disengaged. Because the reality of the dropout thing is that, you know, you don't go to school every day and make good grades and then wake up one day and drop out. It's a real process of disengagement that goes over time. In that panel discussion I was just mentioning that we had last night, there was a student there who said that he had not gone to school for 26 days. He just didn't go to school. And nobody noticed. Nobody called him. Nobody called his mom. Nobody sent a letter. You know, they just kept marking him absent for 26 days. Mm-hmm. And that is something that could never happen at any school that Tanisha Williams Minor is the principal of. I mean, they would go and find that kid and drag him out of bed and back to school if they had to, because they really believe that every kid, you know, has the capacity to overcome whatever they're dealing with as long as they have support. And I think that's really why we chose that school, is because of her vision about reengaging disengaged kids, and her passion and her love of the kids. I think it's something that you just don't see enough of when we talk about education. It's about test scores and money and, you know, privatization. It's not about the fact that most people enter that field because they love kids and they want to help kids. And we as a society need to help them help the kids more than we are.
Or, I know we're sort of out of my time. Do you have a few more minutes? I have a couple more questions. Okay, super. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, some of the teachers you profile. You know, I mentioned the first-year teacher who teaches science, and he is just so great. And it seems as if he has a mentor teacher, a more experienced teacher, to work with him, and I think, you know, sort of following his process of taking what he knows, because he's brilliant, you know, and translating that into the information that the student need in order to matriculate and move through, you know, the educational system is really great to watch, particularly, you know, when he's successful at mm-hmm. this translation and the kids are all happy and they're really engaged and mystified and excited about science.
Right. Well, I think this is one of the great things about DC public schools that I think people don't know. And I'm a parent of a child, and I didn't know that. You know, that there's this part of, you know, part of this linking of test scores to teachers, mm-hmm. like making teachers accountable for the test scores. There is a whole very formal evaluation process that goes along with that, and it involves this mentoring. So schools now have these instructional coaches, and that's what they do. They help teachers teach better. So a new teacher like Smythe would have like a regular series of one-on-one interactions with this coach who, you know, is just very, very experienced and obviously fantastic at what she does. Mm-hmm. So it really, I mean, the teachers are really supported in ways I think that we also don't see. I think, you know, I mean, one of our issues with this film is that we really tried to get DCPS on board to say, you know, this is not an expose about what's wrong with DCPS. This is about teaching and learning in this one building. But I think that there haven't been enough stories that really say that there are some things that these school systems, even embattled ones like DC, are getting right. And I think that whole instructional coach thing is one of the things that DCPS is absolutely getting right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then talk about the in-school suspension coordinator and basketball coach. He's great.
He's a character.
Yeah, Barnes.
He's such a character. He's like our soundbite guy. He like has so many great quotes. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do like, you know, those magic eight balls where you shake it and a saying comes out. We wanted to do one with all his great mm-hmm. Barnes-isms. But, I mean, he was like our kind of keeping it real character, because he had, you know, he had a lot of experience with the criminal justice system. And, you know, he said, like, he knew a lot of these kids' parents when they were in jail. Mm. So he was very real about, like, what they were up against, and really, you know, organically a part of that community. So, you know, and he didn't really have anything to lose. You know, unlike the teachers, I think, and even the principal who, you know, are really trying to follow the rules because these are their careers, you know. And even though they want to do the best job they can, they also know that there's certain parameters that they, you know, they cross that and they're out. Whereas Barnes, I think he just said whatever, you know, thought. And so we get a lot of wisdom from him. And a lot of just, you know, reality checks. It's like, if you come to school, if you come to high school and you can't read, then that's a problem. You know what I mean? We hear it again at the end of the film from Smythe, but it's like, how are you going to learn physics in high school if you can't read?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why are you even showing up in high school if you can't read? You've been to school for 8 years. Somebody should have noticed that you can't read. And those are the kind of issues that a school like this has to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And then they become responsible for teaching that kid how to read and teaching them everything they need to know to progress through high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... Yeah, it's really, really wonderful, you know, to not experience just a day in the life, but a lot of days, like a whole school year in the lives of, you know, this institution and how the institution is not just within those walls, that is outside as well, because, you know, wherever those children are, that's where it goes. I mean, because you think about Head Start, and in Head Start, one of the innovations about that particular program for school, you know, children was that they had parenting education and the teachers would go out in the community to these places where the children live. And you see teachers going to knock on doors where these children live, like, oh, that's nice. Yeah, because all schools are not necessarily going and trying to rescue children that they don't see anymore. Because there are a whole lot of schools that just check the kid off and don't ever wonder what happened to them. And try
right.
to, you know, because sometimes children, they don't have phones in the house, and so you can't call and see where they are. You've got to actually go make that home visit.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And it, you know, I think it's funny. I have a post on Huffington Post that I put up yesterday, and there's been like a really lively debate on it, like a lot of comments, and the conversation is really about parental involvement and how, you know, it's sort of the buck stops with the parents kind of thing. And I agree with that. I mean, like, I think that if you are able to, you should absolutely be, you know, a partner in your child's education. However, I think, you know, if you are a child that has a parent that's absent, whether they're physically absent or, you know, just checked out, or they're addicted to drugs or they're incarcerated, why should you be held accountable for their bad choices? You know, I mean, I think that we have to, I think that's what I, you know, what my takeaway from this is, like, we really have to look at this as a society, and what are we doing as, you know, to wrap around ourselves around these kids and this issue. Because we all know we've got this incredibly huge, you know, income gap and achievement gap and the quality of life gap, but we act like, you know, that doesn't exist. And I think that's the thing that we have to figure out. How do we bring solutions that acknowledge the fact that not every child has a parent that can be a partner in their education?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. But that doesn't mean that the child should fail. And so you all come back, you know, often to the report cards and encouraging the children, okay, you've got an F here, but you've got A's and B's and C's, okay, so, you know, I want you to bring this up. And the children are quite realistic in taking responsibility for the grades that they have. And, you know, we think about the young people who really love playing basketball, but know that they're going to have to sit out the first part of the season to get their grades up because in the pep talk that comes in the beginning, it's like, you know, the coach tells the kids that they're going to leave with an education. They're not going to just appear to, you know, shoot hoops, because that doesn't benefit them. It benefits the institution and this organization and that. But then they leave and they have nothing. So that's really great the way you come back to that a lot in the film, as well as you're looking at sort of outside entities, you know, sort of doing the checking to make sure that there really are as many children there as they say, you know, what is it, the census?
The audit. Mm-hmm.
The audit, right. Yeah, that happens early on in the school year. They start, you know, that's like the first, you know, what, 2-3 months they're doing the audit?
Yeah, the first like 2 months.
Yeah, like, wow, that's quick. Yeah, that's early.
Right.
Yeah, and then they show the great teachers that are, you know, teaching music and how, well, if we don't get the student, get more students, the kids say, well, this teacher's going to be gone and that teacher might be gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's really great the way the film lets the young people show the impact of these policies on their lives and on their education, the quality of that education.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
So lastly, I just wanted you to, like, maybe tell us a little bit about these organizations that you're heading, like the one, like
they're all
you know,
part of they're all part of our work at MBPC. MBPC is a like 30-year old institution that supports African American and Black content from on all platforms. So we do television, we support like web series, we support podcast series, we support anything that we feel like reflects, you know, the complexity of Black experiences all over the world. So we have a series on public television called Afropop that looks at contemporary stories in Africa and the rest of the diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
And then we partner with PBS to do things like In Performance at the White House when they do, you know, a salute to Motown, or they're doing Memphis music in April.
Mm-hmm.
They did blues. They've done the music of the civil rights. You know, we partner with them on those things, as well as other things that come onto public television that we feel like reflects Black experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for the last several years, as things have really changed, you know, like Blog Talk Radio, for example, which didn't used to exist, you know, we've really been trying to figure out how do we support the creation of that content from our perspectives, so that it's not stories about us, it's stories by us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started the New Media Institute to really work with producers to say, okay, you can't just make a documentary film and throw it on hopefully public television or cable anymore. You need to really think about how do you reach an audience online, how can you create new forms of media that maybe organically belong online as opposed to on a broadcast, and really sort of work with them to make that transition to real multi-platform content.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the Public Media Corps, we started that. It grew out of the New Media Institute because we wanted to provide opportunities to people once we sort of help them make that leap to do that work. So we started trying to figure out how do we connect producers with communities through our public media partners. And we found that like one really good way is to sort of bring young people like college graduates or senior, you know, college students in at the point that they're beginning their careers, partner them with high schools and libraries and other places where they help train kids, but they also create their own content.
Mm-hmm.
And get them sort of inducted into the public media universe. Because, you know, one big problem with public television is there's a real lack of diversity. I mean, this series, this 4-hour series, and there's another series that's going to premiere a week later about a Native American woman are, you know, probably two of the few things you're going to see for a while, big things, you know what I mean, that are diverse.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always looking and challenging and pushing within public television, public radio, to say, you know, there's also a diverse community out there of African Americans and Latinos and others who are interested in the kind of thoughtful programming that we do in public television, but you're not reaching out to them, and you're not giving us the resources to reach out to them, so we need to figure out how we do that. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part of our work at the National Black Programming Consortium.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Katrina Project?
That, we really started that, right, as it was happening. We felt like we wanted to hear, you know, again, it's like you're hearing people talk about it, but you're not hearing the people that are in it talk. And when you do hear them, it's these little snippets, you know, that are cut into Anderson Cooper's broadcast. So we had a producer that was from New Orleans and a producer that was in New York sort of collaborating on basically like just archiving people's reactions and communities' reactions to what was happening. And even at the time, sort of a regular update of events, because we launched the site, I think, in November 1st. So was that 2 months after the actual hurricane. And so things were still unfolding. And it was our first online thing that we ever did, like interactive video-based site. And this is before YouTube. So it was, you know, it was a real learning process for us, but one that sort of, like, you know, got us deeply entrenched in, like, what the possibilities of online were, and we've continued to really explore them. We have a series called Black Folk Don't that's been one of our most popular web series that really looks at, like, different kinds of stereotypes, like Black folk don't swim, you know, or Black folk don't ski, or Black folk don't do atheism was the most popular one for some reason. You know, and those kinds of things really reach our audience. And once we reach our audience and they come to blackpublicmedia.org and see what we do, they usually get hooked.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty.
Yeah, yeah, blackpublicmedia.org. There's also a link to 180 school days, or you can just go there straight, you know, just go there directly, 180school days.org for information about this two-part series that's going to be taking off next week on Monday and Tuesday, March 25th and 26th at 9 o'clock, and on your local public broadcasting station. It's going to be really exciting. So in closing, I wanted to ask you sort of what brought you to the type of work that you do, filmmaking and media shifting and changing around the images that represent our people.
Well, that's a long story, but I can try to make it short.
Maybe we can have you on again some other time. That's super.
I started, like, right when I was graduating from Howard, from undergrad, was when Spike Lee was really kind of hitting the scene. He had already done She's Gotta Have It, but he was doing, I guess, School Days, or one of his first, like, big, you know, Hollywood-type films. And there was a lot of sort of attention to that because it had come after a drought of maybe, like, 20 years where there were no African-American Hollywood films. And I got really interested in the conversation around black images and who creates them and what do they mean. And I became the editor of a magazine called Black Film Review, which looked at not only American films, but also African films and films from the diaspora. So, you know, through that Black Film Review experience, I got very deeply into more from a critical standpoint, like images and what do they mean and how do they work. And that really led me to go back to school, to go to Stanford and study documentary filmmaking, and learn more about sort of the history of African Americans in that part of media making and image making. And then I worked for a long time as a producer, you know, as we discussed before, both for public television and for cable. And then I took a break for a couple of years, and I came back and I started as the executive director of MBPC, where, you know, again, it was looking at the same kind of issue around how we represent ourselves and how we're represented in media, but in a very changing world where, you know, video online is as big of a deal as a series on public television. So that's the short version.
Yeah. And do you see that we are actually sort of shaping the image in a way that perhaps, are we having more control of the image? Because I know if we think about sort of the history of film in this country, we didn't necessarily shape the image because we weren't making the films or getting access to those studios that have a more of a national kind of audience. And would you say that because of the sort of the way that filmmaking has become a little bit easier, less expensive because of the different modalities, that we are actually having more control of the image as opposed to being sort of stereotyped and being more victims of a more national type of projection of an image that doesn't represent the norm? If we're talking about Black community?
I think there's good things that have happened and bad things. I think that the bad thing is that I think images in general, not just Black images, but all images, have sort of become vehicles for corporations. I mean, I feel like the whole focus that we have now on celebrity and on money, you know, basically, and like displays of richness and, you know, that really driving like so much of what we see. I mean, when you look at like reality television, for example, it is just astounding that is the highest rated stuff on television. And I think we all are part of that. I don't think it's a Black thing or a white thing or a Latino thing. I think it's an American thing where there's just this hyper capitalist thing going on right now. I think, you know, I mean, in my experience of this over the last 20 years, I think that the late 80s and the early 90s was a real high point in terms of Black images because, as I said, like we were coming off this period where there were literally no Black films coming out of Hollywood for like 15 or 20 years. None. Not a single one. Mm-hmm. And into this sort of burst of films, not all of them were good, you know. There were some that were terrible and very misogynist, in my opinion. But there were a lot of films happening at the same time and a lot of independent films. And what's happened with independent films is they've also become part of different corporate machines. So before, where you'd have a real independent filmmaker, like Quentin Tarantino 20 years ago, would be a real independent filmmaker. You know what I mean? He would just do his thing and get it out there. And now you can't do that. It doesn't work like that. You can't, even if you did make a film outside of that complex, you couldn't get it shown anywhere. You'd have to literally take it around and get people to show it in alternative venues. You know, and I think that's what's changed is that not so much the image making, but the distribution is so locked down by big conglomerates that it's very hard to get stuff out there. And in a way, you know, online should be the place. But as you know, I mean, there's so much noise, and to get through that noise, you need a lot of promotion, marketing, and all those things take time and money, you know? So you're kind of back in the same situation of needing, you know, a lot of money to reach the audience that you want to reach. So I think it's kind of been good and bad. There are more opportunities now to tell more stories, and there are more stories out there, but it's harder to find them.
Yeah, sounds like sort of the same kind of lockdown that has happened with, I guess, you know, television, not cable, but just regular television, and and the radio, not internet radio, but the other radio stations, you know, being owned by a few, and then the studios, you know, sort of being under real, you know, not that many umbrellas. And then we think about sort of the print industry, you know, who's publishing and how that's also, there's just a few publishing houses, and a lot of times they're connected to the film. I mean, there's sort of like, there's like overlap.
Yeah. I mean, I think the black radio thing is like, is the best example. I mean, when you think about like how much regional, local radio we used to have and how great it was, and now you have what? You know what I mean? It's just like, it's, I mean, I think that is probably the best example of how the corporatization of all culture has played out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing that you have the show. And I think Block Talk Radio is great, too. It gives you a lot of choices for, you know, things that you're specifically interested in, as well as just bouncing around and finding things you might not have known was there. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a part of the African Sisters Media Network, and it was bigger, a lot bigger when I first joined the network. I guess it's been 4 years, August this year, and now I think I'm one of the only members of this this network that's still going, you know, without a break.
Well, you go, like, girl,
oh, darn,
as they used to say.
Wow, you know. Well, it'd be really great to have you on again at some point to talk about, you know, the industry, as well as, you know, some of the folks that you watch and that maybe mentored you to be able to do the kind of work you've done for, you say, over 20 years now.
Absolutely. And there's some other films that we support that are that are coming up that, you know, I think you'd also be interested in. So we should definitely talk about those. Yeah.
Okay, great. And I was wondering, since this is International Women's History Month, if there are, you know, any names you'd like to say an Ashe to, or to say a Go Girl to, or, or say, you know, whatever.
Well, I have to say my predecessor at MBPC, who really founded MBPC and was so instrumental in supporting the work of those the pioneers I talked about from the 90s and 80s that were really making independent films available to communities in a way they hadn't been in so long, and challenging stereotypes and offering new images. Her name is Mabel Haddock. She's still around. She's in New York, and she's just an amazing, amazing sister who has supported so many careers and so many visions that I would like to say an ashe to her.
Okay, cool. Super. Thank you so much. And this film series is just so wonderful. And is it going to be available for people to purchase at some point?
It will be available through PBS home video.
Mm-hmm.
It'll also be online, I think, for a week
nice.
Following the broadcast. And I know some stations will have it available on VOD. But it should be available on PBS.org for a week following the broadcast if you miss Monday and Tuesday. But please watch Monday and Tuesday, because we need a lot of people to watch so we can continue to make these kinds of films.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I didn't watch the second part because I wanted to, you know, sort of see it for the first time. So I just watched the first 2 hours.
Oh, you don't know what happened?
No, I don't. So I just wanted to be pleasantly surprised. So when you were saying you didn't give it away, so it's like, good, because I don't know either.
I have to say the second part is pretty dramatic.
Oh, the first part's dramatic. Wow, it gets more dramatic. Okay.
It's way more dramatic.
Okay, nice.
So you have to let me know what you think.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Okay,
awesome.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Jackie, for joining us, and, you know, happy continued filmmaking, and thank you so much for doing the great work you're doing for, you know, around media, and particularly around, you know, sort of allowing other voices that might not have the opportunity to have such an audience, you know, that kind of audience, you know, because it's great hearing from people that we don't see and we don't hear from often, which, you know, these are the majority voices. You know, you did have the little play, you had the part in the film about, we teach the 99%. I like that.
Right.
That was great. Yeah. Well, you take good care.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye. Blessings.
Bye-bye.
So we are going to play a song and then come back. We're gonna, so Butterfly that I played by Robert Glasper, I thought it would really be a great theme looking at transformation and change. So we're going to play another piece. I think we'll play Renee Marie's Lift Every Voice and then let you know what else is happening on the show this morning.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring with a harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicings run high. Loud as the rolling sea, sing a song full of faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of hope that the present has brought us. Facing the
on until victory is won, and it will be won, and we're winning. When you watch this film, 180 Days a Year Inside an American High School, that producer and director Jackie Jones and I were just speaking about, you will see many victories won. And I think this might be one of my guests. Let me see. Good morning. Is this Mr. Clarence? Yes? No? Nope. No, it's not. Is this Clarence Colbertson? No? No? Okay. Just checking.
Oh, pardon me? Checking. I can check on him, too.
Oh, Dr. Scott.
Hi. I'm sorry.
How are you? Oh, I just want to check in before I play another interview just to make sure. Oh, this is so wonderful. We have Dr. Mona Von Scott, who is, are you the director of Black Repertory Group Theater?
Yes, executive director and the artistic director.
Right, right. Well, why don't we just put a plug in really, you know, briefly about these wonderful plays that you have going this month. You brought back the Bessie Coleman story. That's really wonderful. And
correct.
Yeah.
Yes, Bessie Coleman with Natalie Bennett, who was on your show,
mm-hmm.
is amazing, and it's written as you know, and you had attorney Victor Lawhorn. So back by popular demand on Friday, Saturday at 8 and 3 o'clock Saturday matinee, then Natalie is going to do absolutely amazing turnabout on Sunday night. She's going to play Tishba for Dr. Culferson, and I'm going to check and see. I know he was too.
Yeah, he just
today.
Called me. That was him ringing. It was like, I can't talk on
Oh, great,
air.
Great.
And,
and he'll tell you about that, but there are multiplicity of things going on in the theater, and we need you, and people can come with no money. We just want you to get in and see the history.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, well, this is him right here. So let me let you talk
great.
A little bit.
Oh, great. Well, I'll sign off.
No.
You have
no,
a wonderful show.
No, he's not he's not calling the studio. He's calling my mobile number, which I can't talk to him on.
Oh, wow. Well, let me try to get him. He probably has the... I'll try to. He's got it mixed up. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll call him now and get him to call you.
That'd be super.
Because we've been waiting. I was up at 4:30 waiting for the show.
Oh my God! Seriously, 4:30?
You do wonderful work. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. I'll call him right now.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. So, Doctor. Clarence R. Culbertson is a native New Yorker, and he's both an accomplished playwright as well as musician, a percussionist, and he's written over 19 plays, of which 16 have been produced professionally. And he has an MFA in dramatic writing from New York University and has taught and directed theater throughout the United States and in the Caribbean. He has taught playwriting at Yale and has his plays presented there as well as at Cornell and a number of universities and high schools on the East Coast. He has been a playwright in residence at a number of New York-based theater companies, including but not limited to the National Black Theater, Frank Silvera's Writers Workshop, Black Spectrum Theater, Theater for a New Audience, Baca Downtown Theater, Henry Street Settlement House, Jean Frankel Theater, and the Caribbean Repertory Theater. He spent 15 years in the Caribbean, and while there, along with his actress wife, founded Carabana Ensemble Theater Company, of which he is artistic director. In 1996, his play Faith Journey, A Celebration of Martin, had a six-month run at Broadway's Lamb Theater. And so he is presenting at the Black Repertory Group Theater, Tituba and Nat. And so we're going to talk to him. Let me see if he's joined us in the studio. No, not yet. So... let me see. So I'm going to play another Renee Marie. Not sure I'm going to play another Robert Glasper. I'm going to play No Worries. And then we'll have him in the studio by then because he's calling me again on my mobile. Here we go.
On the drums, Chris Days. On the bass is Vicente Archie. And the man himself. Please put your hands together, the Robert Glasper Trois.
Mm-hmm.
have our director in the studio, Mr. Clarence, and I don't want to kill your last name because I think I've been doing so.
Cuthbertson.
How do you say it again?
Cuthbertson.
Cuthbertson.
Yeah.
Cuthbertson. Okay. And I also have Dr. Scott on the air, too, because, you know, she has introduced your wonderful work to our Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area community, and I wanted the two of you to be on the air together for a minute so she can talk about, you know, this, you know, bringing it back. So I'm so happy that, you know, the work has come back because I missed it. So that's really great. So I hear that you had a special rehearsal with the cast, and so last Sunday was the opening weekend for the bringing the two plays, Tituba and Nat, back to Bay Area audiences. And how did that go?
Oh, it went very well. It went very well. It's called a pickup rehearsal, and what we tried to do was just go over things that we'd gone over before and, mm-hmm. and tighten some other things. And so it went very well. I was pleased.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. And Dr. Scott, how did you come to know this famous playwright? Like, you've got, I mean, last Thursday we talked, and you were, like, writing a play in the library.
Yes. It was a blessing. You know, sometimes I'm a great believer in God. I think God sent him the time that we really needed him, and just in time for Black History. And we needed some more plays, and we wanted to have opportunity for Natalie Bennett, who has been with us over 12 years and one of the greatest actresses, and then she had to play something that she could feel, and then to have, we call him Dr. C, Dr. Cuthbertson, to come in. Maybe he could tell you what made him come to Black Rep, but I think it was a blessing. But he came in, and he was just like at home. And then he had worked with the people who worked with the greatest of directors and writers. He'll tell you about it. I don't want to take anything away, so he'll have something to say. But we just truly blessed, Wanda, as we are blessed to have you to keep on perpetuating the culture. And he was exactly what my mother would have chosen to come, you know.
Right.
World renowned and having taught at Yale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dr.
So when,
C, you can.
Yeah, so when are the plays? Because it's a limited engagement. So give us those details. I know it's on Sunday at 8 o'clock, but I came the Sunday when the house was closed, and so I just want to make sure people know when they can catch these plays. So
yes.
What are the dates?
Dr. C.
Okay. On Sunday is going to be, I believe it's going to be a performance of Betsy Coleman early in the day, and then we're gonna do both Tituba and Nat later on in the evening. I believe it's at 8 o'clock showing. Right.
Oh wow!
Okay,
so all three plays are happening this Sunday. Wow, that's excellent. What are the dates on Sunday? This Sunday, what's the date?
You mean the time?
No, the date and the time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's Sunday the 24th. I mean, 24th,
okay.
Maybe the 25th. Mm-hmm. And the times are, I think Betsy is going to go up at 3.
Okay.
And then Nat and Tita can go up at 8 o'clock.
Okay. Oh, great.
Yes. And Betsy Coleman will also be on Friday and Saturday night at 8
mm-hmm.
and Saturday matinee at 3 p.m.
Okay. So 8 and then Saturday has a matinee at 3 as well. Okay.
Yes.
And is this throughout the rest of the month? Like, is it the following week as well or just this weekend coming?
Look, Betsy will go on to the 30th, and I want to say that we're having at 6 p.m. an honoring of one of our great actresses who passed away. Marianne Broussard, whom you know has been in a lot of our plays,
yeah.
And her twin sister, Betty Ann. who played a lot with Natalie Bennett, who's the star of Bessie Coleman, as you know. So we're inviting everybody to come out at 6 and to honor all of our seasoned actors and just everyone to honor her and to honor Natalie. And then Natalie will be going on that Friday at 8. And then for the whole, she'll be there till the 30th.
Okay,
Excuse me, it's on the 30th when we honor Mary Ann Broussard's sister, Betty Ann Broussard, the twin. It'll be the next week, it'll be also Friday and Saturday at 8, but Saturday is a special honoring.
Okay, great. Yeah, and so with Nat and Tituba, are they... Is this it for that run this Sunday?
Dr. C,
yeah,
I was hoping you could also do that. We can.
Well, we're undecided whether or not it's going to be the final performance or not, but we'll know before this weekend.
He's backed by popular demand. That's why we seem like we don't have the exact dates. We just keep enticing him to come back. And Natalie has to play both of these very rigorous roles in the same day. It's just amazing to go from Bessie to Tisha B'Av.
Yeah, yeah. So tell us about these two works, Dr. C, and your inspiration for Tituba B'Av, because it's really interesting when Black Rep was mounting this particular play, there was a stage reading by another playwright of this Black woman's story that is not very well known. Lorraine Hansberry Theater was doing a stage reading, and I'm like, whoa! And I had to check to make sure it was. I wanted to see, like, was it your play? Was it someone else? And it was someone else, but the same topic. So tell us about this woman and what happened to her.
Okay, well, yeah, Lorraine Hansberry, they did do a reading. I believe it was Oyama, who used to be Charles Gordon. The difference was the one that Lorraine Hansberry did. It was a lot of characters, like 13 characters, from what they told me. My play is what's called a monodrama. It's a one-woman show. And the reason why I wrote Tituba is because my grandfather is a native of Barbados. He's from Barbados. And when I was a young boy, he told me, knowing I was going to be a writer, he said, whatever you do, get that thing straight about Tituba that Arthur Miller had written about in the Crucible. So I said, okay. And I had forgotten about it until later on when I was in graduate school and I read the Crucible and this woman's name came up. And when my grandfather told me about it, he said, whatever you do, follow the name. So when I started researching it, I went to the Arthur Schoenberg Library in Harlem, which is the largest library in the world on Black culture. And sure enough, they had this information about this woman named Tituba. And the first thing I realized was that her name was not Tituba, and she wasn't from Barbados. In fact, she was from South America, and she was part Arawak. And when she and her mother were captured by the Spaniards, her mother told her, whatever you do, do not ever tell her your name. So when they asked her, what is your name? She said, I am a Tichabin, which was the name of her tribe, which is a subcategory of the Arawaks. So when she got to Barbados, that name stuck, Tituba. So in the history records, we don't know her as Marion Robinson or Frances Johnson. We know her as Tituba. And I thought her story was fascinating because when we did it, at Yale, I had a conversation with Arthur Miller. And
You met Arthur Miller?
Oh. Well, yeah, because he lives in New Haven, which is where Yale is located. And we did the play in Yale. And we had a discussion, and, you know, he told me why he wrote the play, basically. And the basic reason why he wrote the play, Crucible, was he wanted to show the parallels between what happened in Salem, Massachusetts in 1882 and what was happening to him as a member, as part of the Joseph McCarthy era. The Joseph McCarthy era was a time when a lot of artists, black and white, were being accused of being socialist or leftist or communist. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those.
Oh.
And he felt that that was the epitome of intolerance.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was trying to show that that was the same thing that happened during the Salem witch hunts.
Yes, what happened to Paul Robeson around the McCarthy era?
Well, Paul Robeson and a bunch of other people. I mean, Harold Belafonte was caught up in that. James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, you know, a bunch of people.
Right.
But that's why he wrote it. And then in our conversation, he asked me where I got this information about this woman named Titova. And I asked him the same thing. You know, I said, where did you get yours? And he basically said he got his information from the news reports and from the trial transcript. But he never went any further than that. Because in his description of Titova in the Crucible, he describes her as very matronly, very old, and very mystical, and also from Barbados. And in fact, she was just the opposite. She was very young. She was very pretty. And she was very exotic. I mean, she did have some special gifts. You know, being that she was an Arawak, and she's also part African. Her father was an Ashanti.
Mm-hmm.
And and also, over the last 10 or 15 years, I suspect, I have been concentrating my playwriting on writing about individuals from the African diaspora who have been marginalized in the writing of American history.
Mm-hmm.
And Titova is one of those persons. Nat Turner is another one. And there's several others who I've written about. And, you know, that's the genesis of how Titova came about.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned in the same way, except for the fact that many people, especially young people, do not even know about Nat Turner, which I think is not too good. And so I just wanted to share, you know, that part of his history with an audience to know that... you know, that this man lived and what he did and the significance of what he did and the consequences of what he did in terms of black people and how it affected slavery.
Yeah, but back to Titova, which is not her name. Actually, it's the name of, you know, the...
Her tribe.
Her tribe, yeah, her ethnic group. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about her. I read a book a long time ago about her, and I think it was a juvenile nonfiction book, Titova, Black Witch of Salem. And I was wondering if you could talk about that, because a lot of times, you know, people think about the Salem witch hunts, and there are witch hunts today. You know, you think about the isolation of certain women in communities. I'm thinking in Africa in particular, where something might happen in the community, and they look to find the reason for this plague or this problem, and then they say, oh, you know, somebody put a spell on, let's go get these women, or let's go get this person. And so and there's these communities of, quote, witches that live outside of the community, and as long as they stay in their sort of like isolation, you know, this place away from the community, then they're okay. But if they try to venture back into the large society, then they're persecuted and killed sometimes. So if you could talk about this Titova, and because she actually lived, and, you know, she's a historic figure, and who is she, like, and what you know about her?
Okay, well, first of all, she was first taken to Barbados with her mother, and then her mother passed away, and then this man named Paris came down from Boston, because the people who she had been sold to in Barbados, they had ran out of money. And so in exchange for the money that they owed Paris, they gave him Titova, So he came down and took her back to Boston with him. And again, you know, he was a Quaker. They were Quakers. And at one point, Paris decided to become a preacher. And he moved to Salem, which is right outside of Boston. And he got married and he had two children. And Titchener became more or less the nanny to these two children. And another odd thing, not odd, but idiosyncrasy about her story is that at the time, you know, Boston and in most of the areas, you know, above the Mason-Dixon line were non-slave states. But yet she was a slave in his household, in this guy Paris' household, even though, you know, Boston wasn't considered, or Massachusetts wasn't considered a slave state. Okay, and so, but because of the way she looked and because of certain things that had been told about her by these people in Barbados, Paris as well as his neighbors felt that Titchener was a very exotic woman. Number one, because she looked exotic. And secondly, because she kind of did things which were contrary, you know, to what you know, the Quakers were used to. For instance, it's alleged that she was able to talk to dogs, or animals in particular. It was alleged that she had certain powers that would make certain things live a certain way. It was alleged that she had a garden in front of the Paris's house, and when all the gardens in the neighborhood died, hers was the only one that that lived. So to the Quakers, she was different. And when this whole matter came up with these folks in Salem becoming ill, and these young girls pointing a finger at Titchener, she was the likely scapegoat. Okay. And when she was tending or being the nanny to these four girls, she did do things which amazed them, but in no way amazed them to the point where she should have been accused of being a witch. Now, in terms of the backstory or in terms of the story in itself, it's interesting because the play takes place in jail when she is being interviewed by this anonymous newspaper man. And even though a number of people were killed as a result of this scare, upwards of 60 people were killed, Titchener was not killed. You know, she remained in jail until she was actually let out of jail. So, you know, I find that very interesting. Moreover, the reason why the witch hunts were terminated was because the finger had been pointed at the governor's wife. And when that happened, the governor said, well, wait a minute, you know, this is going a bit too far. And they realized that it was something other than, you know, witchcraft that was making all these people become ill. And much later, it was found out that because, you see, the Quakers were involved in the cultivation of rye and wheat as one of the staples of the diet. And one batch of rye had become a fungus had developed. And the result of it, of eating it, was the same as a psychedelic drug, LSD. Okay, and so when they would take this, they would become like crazy. But they didn't realize it because they didn't know what the cause was. Mm-hmm. And they associated that with craziness and, you know, witchcraft. Another interesting fact about Titchener's life is that once she was actually let out of jail, she falls off the history pages. We don't know what happened to her. We don't know what happened, you know, if she went with this guy named John Island back to Barbados, if she went to Europe, but we don't know what happened to her. Those are the most poignant things that I can tell you that I know about her, except for the fact that I just found her story interesting, and every place that the play has been presented, the people find her story intriguing, and they also find it interesting, you know, that this woman plays such a main part in witch hunts.
It's sort of like criminalizing, you know, one's ability to be one with, you know, other life, you know, other, like the women who knew how to use herbs medicinally and who knew about the rhythms of the you know, the earth and mm-hmm. other inhabitants besides human beings were seen as unusual. I mean, of course, you know, we think about, I mean, all life communicates, and one can actually communicate with other life forms. You know, mm-hmm. so she was there that she could talk to her dog. Well, probably, you know, she probably could. But then we probably could all talk to our dogs and cats and listen to the trees and the whispers of the grasses if we just was just quiet ourselves and remove our ego.
It's not even about quiet, but it's about that these were gifts that we had at one point that mm-hmm. over time we have lost, like this whole, you know, idea about the third eye or the pineal gland. I mean, this is something which was, you know, in ancient times a vital way of communication. But in times we've lost that ability to use the pineal gland, but, you know, but there's still some people who can tap into that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the same kind of concept. Mm-hmm. You know, that certain people do have certain gifts that are unbelievable to other people. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah. Well, I meant, you know, quieting, not quiet like no noise. I meant like quieting, you know, the...
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, not... It's more like just sort of quieting the spirit, you know, the kind of space we go into when we go deep into ourselves. You know, a lot of mm-hmm. people do that when they meditate. Mm-hmm. To sort of be able to move away all of the distractive types of energies that keep us from being connected to other energy that's not as compromised,
right.
You know, by the kind of things that human beings compromise themselves with. So I wonder if you could tell us about some of your other, because you mentioned that these two pieces, Nat Turner piece and the Tituba piece, are a part of a series of what you call, I wrote it down, monodramas. What other monodramas have you written?
Well, I've written a piece about Toussaint Louverture, who was the liberator of Haiti, which is not, really not a monodrama, but it's, you know, it's a four character play.
Mm-hmm.
In the Caribbean, where I lived for about 15 years, there's a number. Let me put it this way: what happens in the Caribbean is that people are celebrated even before they die. Okay, so you have, you know, schools that are named and roads that are named and airports that are named. You know, while people are still living, and that happens a lot because they want history to be played out in front of, you know, people who are still living, particularly young people, and that's done a lot. So there's a lot of historical figures in the Caribbean who I've written about. There's a gentleman. It's not Papa John, but in the play it's called Papa John, and it's about the oldest man in the Caribbean, where a book was written about 15 years ago about this man, who's from Antigua. And so I wrote a one-man play about him. There's a woman named Arona Peterson, who was a noted herbalist and restaurateur in the Virgin Islands, and she's also a folklorist and a writer. Culture icon, and I've written about her. There's a woman by the name of Queen Mary, who was a liberator from St. Croix, which is one of the islands of the Virgin Islands. I've written about her. There was a white governor of the Virgin Islands who was who had a mistress who was an ex-slave. and who for 20 years ran the Virgin Islands and is considered one of the most noted governors of the Virgin Islands, him along with his mistress. His name was Peter, I forget his last name, but her name was Anna Haygarth. And I wrote a play called Dear Peter, Dear Anna, about them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't even remember all of them. Right now, I'm working on a play about Adam Clayton Powell, who was a noted black congressman from the Harlem era, during the 30s, 40s, and 50s in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kind of things.
I want to ask you about Adam Clayton Powell. Is he the one that advised Martin King to distance himself from Byard Rustin?
Yes.
That was messed up. I understood the reasoning because of the homophobia, and Byard Rustin wasn't discreet around, his love of other men. However,
what he actually said is that he was going to put it out that Martin Luther King and Byard Rustin had an affair. That's what he was going to say.
That's so wrong. That wasn't even true.
I know. But because Martin Luther wasn't true, but a lot of people knew about Byard Rustin, they figured that they would come to the conclusion, Byard Rustin, because Byard Rustin used to be Martin Luther King, one of his lieutenants.
He was like his big brother and advisor. He's the one brought to Martin King's attention about, his whole resistance strategy.
Right.
Looking at Gandhi's. Yeah.
Right.
That was Byard Rustin's, sort of sharing that with him. And then Byard Rustin also is one of the architects of the March on Washington.
Yeah.
But he was more behind the scenes, and because of this whispering and.
He's also a socialist. Byard Rustin was a socialist.
That's true. He was.
An avowed socialist. But, I mean, that's neither here nor there. But, it's the same Adam Clayton Powell.
Yeah, because when I read that, and I'm like, he did a lot of good things, but I didn't like that. I thought that was really he was more going with the status quo as opposed to, sort of opening new, sort of being his own person.
But you see, it's for New York, is for Black New York, and for Harlemites in particular, he was a hero. He was a political icon because he did buck the system, number one. And moreover, up until the latter years, he passed more social legislation than any man in the history of Congress,
mm-hmm.
Being Congress or Senate. I mean, he passed more than anybody. Going back to the New Deal days, he's not getting credit for even to this day for that, because things that we take advantage of now, he was responsible for during some very tough times, mm-hmm. during Eisenhower and Nixon's administration, he was a beloved minister of Abyssinian Baptist Church.
So
he did some wrong things, and he was flamboyant, and he had tax problems, and he was married three times, and blah, blah, blah. But, nevertheless, he was, like I said, he was a political icon. He was a man before his time. There hasn't been a politician like him, even Obama. There hasn't been a politician that has been as loved as he was,
Yeah, I was just thinking about Whitney Young and what he did, with regards to for the civil rights movement around, having tangible outcomes around jobs and around health,
mm-hmm.
and how, he basically, unlike, Adam Clayton Powell, people really misunderstood him, Whitney Young, and, called him all these, like a sellout and a this and a that. So Whitney Young and Adam Clayton Powell, were contemporaries, right?
Well, yeah, I knew there was Verdon Jordan with the
And there was real controversial too.
There was Floyd McKissick with Core.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was a bunch of them during that time, but you know, but the government also was about, you know, trying to malign these same people, you know, because they were considered liberal leaders, you know. So Adam Clayton Powell and Floyd McKissick and with the, I mean, they weren't the only ones, but, I mean, when obviously, you know, Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael. It's just that was the time. I mean, you know, the 60s was, you know, an era that had never been, you know, in American history, you know. And, you know, there was a lot of pros and there was a lot of cons. And one of the pros was, you know, it was black empowerment. And then on the other hand, there was, you know, the white resentment, you know, which led into Nixon and all that conservative, you know, anti-progressive stuff. You know, so there was a lot of pros and cons, you know. But, you know, I lived through it and a lot of my contemporaries did. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of that has not been passed down, you know, to future generations. You know, a lot of people, black people in particular, think, you know, our history started with slavery, you know, and it did, you know. You know, our history, you know, is very long and precedes, you know, even, you know, other people's history. But, you know, a lot of us don't know that. You know, and a lot of us think, you know, it started with, you know, in 1620, you know, with people landing in Virginia. But, you know, that's not about it. And then there's been a lot of heroes and sheroes since then, you know. And a lot of them came, you know, into being during the 60s. But, you know, a lot of them were even before then, you know, W.E. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, you know, and all these folks, you know. But that's the idea. What I'm trying to do as a playwright is to bring to the forefront, you know, the lives of these people, so that we can start thinking about these more often, and quite frankly, start coming to theater. I mean, you know, we need to come to theater other than to come to see comedy and to see musicals.
So why don't you talk about a little bit about you know, your call to write and to do theater in particular. But before that, I was just noticing that you have a play, Faith Journey, a celebration of Martin, and as opposed, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. And we're approaching the end of the season of peace, which is April 4th, which is the anniversary. I think it's the 45th anniversary, maybe, of the assassination of Martin King. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that play, and then wanted to ask you about sort of how you came to be a writer and a playwright specifically. And then I wanted you to talk about some of the plays that you had a female protagonist, since this is Women's History Month. And, you know, we talk about Tituba, definitely woman, you know, who, you know, was really strong in her convictions and in herself, you know, to remain who she was, and despite society's, you know, sort of persecution and of her, like, you know, other women who were not necessarily the type of women that society was used to.
Yeah. Okay. Faith Journey. First of all, Faith Journey was commissioned by you know some people for me to write, and it appeared on Broadway, a theater called the Lambs Theater, in June of 1996, I believe.
And yes.
I think it ran for like 9 months. What it is, it's called Faith Journey, a celebration of Martin. It really is not about Martin. It was about a person like Martin. It was about, you know, a preacher like Martin. And the reason why it's called a celebration of Martin is because it's my belief, and I think it came through in the play, that even though men get all the prominence, it's really women who are the grunts for politicians and for men in general. I mean, in other words, women do the hard work. They do the grunt work. They do the petitioning. They do the calling. They go, you know, door to door, and they do the work. And so this play was, again, it was about a caricature like Martin, but it was also about the women behind him who made him what he was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's a musical. It was a gospel musical.
Oh.
And it was about this preacher who, you know, was involved in the civil rights movement, and who had come from one part of the South to another part, and I believe it was Birmingham. And he came with some people from his church, one who was a secretary who was mulatto, who he was, you know, attracted to. And during the course of the movement, the NAACP sent down a lawyer from the North, which, you know, who was a black lawyer, female lawyer, who was very intelligent, very sophisticated, and who the preacher became smitten by. So he was torn between this woman who came down from the North and this woman who he had been seeing all the time. And then in the middle of this, he was trying to, you know, lead this movement. And so the whole play evolved around the resolution of, you know, these two aspects of his life, his love life on the one hand and his love of the movement on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it did very well. It was the first time that, you know, I had done a lot of off-Broadway stuff, but it was the first time I had done anything on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a learning curve for me, and it was a very enlightening experience because, you know, when you get on Broadway, you're dealing with, you know, the best of the best in terms of, you know, professional stagecraft. So, you know, it was good in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of... quite frankly, you know, I've written a number of plays, and in the majority of my plays, females have been the protagonists, and I suspect the one reason that is because my ex-wife, she was an actress of extreme talent. And so, for instance, Tituba was written for her. And then in a couple other plays, but she was the template for a lot of my plays. And it was good because, you know, one thing that I look for in directing actors is their ability to take directions and their ability to bring something to the play which is not there. And she was able to do that, you know, in many respects, to the point where, you know, she said or thought a thing should be done was right, and I had to rewrite, you know, in order to accommodate what, you know, she had suggested, because she was just right on. So that was one reason. And then the other reason is because I believe I come from a very large family. There was 12 of us, and my mother was very central in our family. I mean, you know, she was the anchor in our family, and she was full-blood Cherokee, and so she used to tell us a lot about, you know, Native Americans and the way they lived. She's also a writer. And I was always fascinated by these stories. And one story that she would tell was the fact that in the Native American society, the patriarchy, you know, was the norm, that everything came from the father's line. And then when the colonists killed off the males in the Native American society, that basically killed their society. And that's why, you know, they went into the reservations without fighting, okay, let me put it that way. And so she would emphasize to us that one of the reasons why black people have survived or humiliation there to survive is because the black woman, you know, has been so critical in the black families. And because of that, you know, families has, and there's a lot of, in my view, there's a lot of truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, black people have survived. And often, you know, it's because of the strength of the black woman. So what I try to do in my work, quite frankly, is try to celebrate that
mm-hmm.
by writing plays about women,
mm-hmm.
Where women are the central characters. And, you know, there's a play that the Black Repertory Group has now called Sisters. That's about that. It's about two women. There's another play that they have called Death as a Constant Companion.
Mm-hmm.
That's a two-women play. And there's a number of plays that I have written. One is called Under the Tamarind Tree.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Caribbean play. That's about three women. And like I mentioned, Queen Mary before. There's another play that I've written called, I don't remember the name of it now, but it's about a woman. But and so that's my rationale. You know, I can't even think of all of them offhand, but there's
well,
a number
of them.
Well,
you got a lot of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, you know, women happen to be the main character. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, people ask artists in particular, well, you know, you're not a woman, how can you write about women? And Steven Spielberg had a good reply when they asked him about that. And they said, well, you're not a Martian, how can you write about E.T.? And he said, well, you ain't got to go to Mars and write about E.T. You know, it's all come from your imagination. why you gotta be that to do that, you know? And that's very real. I mean, that's just a very real kind of response. You don't have to be a woman to write about women issues. You know, you don't have to be a man to write about man issues.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of your artistry. I mean, simple as that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, because I was so affected, all of my brothers, by our mother, her strength, that, you know, it's kind of a celebration to her, too. She's passed away now, but, you know, she was aware of this when she was alive, because she used to go to all my plays.
Nice, yeah. Yeah, so how did you come into, you know, your current career, you know, as a writer?
Okay, yeah. So when I was younger, I grew up in New York City, and when I was in what we call a junior high school, then they call it middle school, I was the editor of my new school newspaper,
mm-hmm.
and we had won a citywide award for excellence in reporting. And as a reward, our advisor took us to see A Raisin in the Sun, which was the first black drama on Broadway, the first black drama by a female, and the first black drama directed by a black man, Lloyd Richards, who I met, who used to be at Yale, too. Anyway, so that was the first for the – so anyway, so our advisor took us to see it. And we're talking about 1959, so that kind of ages me a bit. And I was impressed. And so after the play, you know, the advisor came up to me and said, hey, well, Carl, what do you think about that? And I said, well, you know, I can do that. I can make people talk on stage like that.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, well, you should become a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all she needed to say. That was a seed that she planted.
Mm-hmm.
That later on, after, you know, in college and later on in graduate school, I decided, you know, I'm going to be a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, writing became a passion with me anyway, and playwriting in particular. I'm also a musician, so both of those two art forms kind of were embedded in me at a very early age.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I've ever done. I mean, you know, my whole life and my whole raising four children, you know, has been in the arts and theater.
Wow.
You know, along with my wife, who's also, you know, she's my ex-wife, who's also an actress. So
mm-hmm.
that's what I did. I either played music, I was a studio musician, or I wrote plays and included music in plays and taught. And I also taught playwriting in a number of places.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That's what I did. It was a passion that
mm-hmm.
you know, has never left me, and then they probably never will. One time I was on stage, and somebody asked me, "Oh, when are you gonna retire?" And I said, "I'm like the mafia. We don't retire."
Yeah. So you're a percussionist. That's what it says in your bio. So yes, are you still doing music? Are you still performing that way as well?
I do that when like in my plays, both plays. You know, I play music. Music is mine. Mm-hmm. And I used, before I left the Virgin Islands about 5 years ago, I was a member of a group because I play all kinds of music. I ended up playing jazz because I used to play in the club. And it was only three of us, but we used to hold down this club, and it was just straight up jazz we played. Mm-hmm. But I played everything. I played, you know, reggae and calypso and popular music, and you know, I've been in the studio. For a long time, I used to play with John Lucien. I don't know if you ever heard of John Lucien, but
yes.
He was around during the 70s, and he's actually from the Virgin Islands, where I used to live. And he had come back to the Virgin Islands for like almost like a R&R. And he's a renowned bass player, too. So he put together jazz quartet, and we used to play together, and then we did some stuff in the studio. So
right.
I played with him for about 5-6 years,
mm-hmm.
and some other folks along the line.
Right.
But those are the things that I do. I play music, and I write, played.
Right, yeah. So I wanted to ask you, in closing, how, you know, what do you think about your cast, Clarence, Ray Johnson, and Nat Turner, and Natalie Bennett, and Tituba?
Well, I think they're both excellent, you know, actors,
mm-hmm.
and I keep I'm not informing them, but keep reminding them that their talents are so big that they really need to be in the theater capital of the world, which is in New York, where, you know, with their talents, you know, they would really actually blow up because. I mean, they really did that good. In fact, my son, who lives in San Francisco, he's a filmmaker. He used to be our stage manager when he lived in the same town. He lived in the Virgin Islands. He came to both plays, mm-hmm. and he seen both plays. And as a matter of fact, he seen his mother in Tituba,
mm-hmm.
because that's also been filmed by PBS. And before I left San Diego, he stage managed Nat down there,
mm-hmm.
and so I asked him, you know, after the show, I said, his name is Callis. I said, Callis, you know, well, what do you think? He said, Dad, he said, those actors were better than any that I've seen you do these two productions with. And he, other than his mother, he's probably right.
Wow.
So you know, in response to your question, I just think that their talents are being underutilized,
mm-hmm.
here, you know, in,
yeah.
well, not really underutilized, but, one thing that is, you know, that is real, is, you know, the West Coast is about, you know, movie land, it's about Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
okay, and all of that. The East Coast, on the other hand, is really about theater. It's about theater, music, and dance. And there's film happening there, too, but, I mean, if you really want to be a stage actor, you know, you've got to at least touch base with what goes on out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in my view, and then I know a lot of stage actors, you know, a lot of them whose names that you know. And I believe that the best actors come from the stage anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think movie stars are made, you know, but actors are people who, you know, they got the craft together. You know, people like Denzel Washington and
right.
Dustin Hoffman, and Al Pacino, you know, Marlon Brando, I mean, Morgan Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those people are actors, you know.
Right.
And there's other people like Will Smith, who's a movie star,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah, they make big money, but they're still movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
But actors are actors. And people like Denzel, they will always go back to the stage. And they do. I mean, I've seen him in stage, so even though he's as bigged up as Al Pacino, I've seen him in stage. You know, I mean, these people, they always go back to the stage because that's where it really happens, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, your best actors, and the best ones come from overseas, they come from Britain, you know, all come from the stage, you know. They're all, you know, are stage actors. So, you know, my retort to both Clarence and Natalie is, hey, look, you know, y'all need to, you know, y'all need to be in another environment in order, if this is what you want to do, you know. And quite frankly, you know, I'm willing to take them, you know, to other venues to do what they do because I just think they do it that well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I definitely enjoyed seeing Natalie in the Bessie Coleman piece. Looking forward mm-hmm. to seeing her in Tituba and seeing Clarence. I've seen Clarence in lots of pieces at Black Rep. Looking forward to seeing him in your mm-hmm. piece as well this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for joining us today to talk about these two plays that are currently at Black Repertory Group Theater. And they mm-hmm. are being, people can catch them at 8 o'clock on Sunday, March 24th. Is that correct?
Whatever this coming Sunday is, yeah. I don't know if it's going on.
Yeah, I think it's the 24th, right, yeah. And the Black Repertory Group Theater is located right there on Adeline. I think it's
3201 Adeline, right there in the corner.
Right. Yeah, and it's right across the street from the Ashby BART station.
It's down the street from it. It's not across the street from it. It's down the street, two blocks down.
Well, yeah, you can see it. You can see the sign. Right, exactly. And do you have a website or anything where people can sort of stay in touch and see what you're working on?
Well, I mean, they can Google my name and they can see my name, or they can go up and my company is Caravana, Caravana, Ensemble Theater Company. They can go up and see some stuff on that.
Okay, cool, super. Well, good luck on your play on Adam Clayton Powell. That should be cool when that comes to fruition. And have you had a chance to see Katori Hall's The Mountaintop at a the Lucy Stern Theater as a part of Theater Works Silicon Valley season?
No, not yet. I read about it. They got some good reviews, and it's curious. You know, the concept is curious. Not curious, but the concept is good. It's the last night he spent the night at the motel, and it's interesting because it's a two-character play, so I'm curious to see how they did that, you know,
I think it's really well done.
You saw it?
Oh, yeah, uh-huh, yeah, that's why I'm mentioning
okay.
Yeah, and I'm mentioning it also because of the piece that you have, you know, that we talked about, and around, you know, because of the time period we're in presently, and your, you know, what we talked about with regards to centrality of women and women's stories in much of the work that you've written. For the reasons that you told us. So anyway, right. I just thought this play seems like one of your kind of plays, you know. I think you'll like
it. Okay. Sounds good.
All right, cool. Well thank you again so much.
Thank you for introducing me to your audience.
Sure. I look forward to talking to you again.
Okay.
All right,
bye-bye. Have a blessed day.
You too. Peace and blessings. So we are going to close with another Glasper, and this time we'll let it play all the way through, and it's called Open Mind.
All that we are is a result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. All that we are. As a man thinks, he is. Creating in your mind the change which you wish to bring about in yourself.
And therein lies the purpose of this record.
not possible for us to be awakened from what we call our normal life. Transcendental. And the dream wakes us from his sleep.
Just let your mind dwell on the idea of sound, sound, sound.